Welcome to the Radiant Podcast. We are so glad you joined us today. This podcast features messages, interviews, and discussions from Radiant Church located in Seneca, South Carolina. For more information about Radiant, visit radiantchurchsc.com. Here's today's episode. Well, hello and welcome to the Radiant Church Podcast. My name is Andrew Bullard. I am the pastor at Radiant Church. We're a church located in Seneca, South Carolina, really just 10 minutes or so from the campus of Clemson University. And we got a special podcast episode I'm bringing to you guys here today. We generally use our podcast feed just to put our messages out. So our Sunday morning messages and teachings are available every week on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you happen to listen to your podcasts. They're also available on our YouTube channel and online. In fact, right now would be a great time to subscribe to either format, whether our YouTube channel or subscribe right here to the podcast platform you're listening to, so that you're able to get those teachings when they come out. They normally come out every Sunday evening, Monday morning, somewhere in there. But every so often, I'll throw in a podcast episode like the one we're going to do today that really just sort of kind of fills in some gaps. There's only so much you can put into a Sunday morning teaching, and there's a lot of stuff that gets left on the cutting room floor, so to speak, right? You know, there's a lot of research and writing and notes, and you guys, if you'd be surprised how the sausage is made, man. I got all kinds of things I don't put in into a teaching. And we're starting this brand new teaching series in 2025, going through the Gospel of John. It's going to take us through most of the year. We're going to finish sometime next year. We'll take a break when the fall hits later this year and pick it back up after the holidays in 2026. But we're going to go verse by verse, passage by passage, and I'm really looking forward to doing that. But one of the things I wanted to establish from the get-go was I wanted to help you see the world that Jesus was living in. I think a lot of times we read the scriptures and read the gospels, and we don't get a feel for, you know, Jesus as the person. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on that today. But you know, I mean, he laughed, he cut up, he had jokes, he had fun. Like, he wasn't stiff and serious all the time. I think we've done a poor job making him out to be this, you know, stick in the mud kind of guy. He certainly wasn't that. But we also don't get a feel for the world that he was in. I mean, think about your world. Think about how much of our world today is dominated by politics and culture and, you know, language, and how that shapes your worldview. We don't really spend a lot of time on that. And I think if you can understand those elements, you better appreciate, and I think better understand too, the scriptures. And especially when we get to a narrative like the gospels that tell you the story of Jesus. So here's what I want to do with you today. I want to take you through what happens from Malachi to Matthew, basically kind of the end of what we would consider the Old Testament era period to when Jesus is on the scene here in the New Testament. Now, I want to start, excuse me, with Malachi. A lot of folks will say this about Malachi, that once Malachi ends, God was silent for 400 years. I don't know if you grew up in church like I did, you hear that kind of stuff all the time. And you're like, okay, God silent for 400, that means there was just nothing. Like, people were praying and nothing was happening. It's actually not true. And I've grown to really just dislike that phrase. God wasn't silent for 400 years. What you had in that time period was you didn't have prophetic revelation. So we don't have prophetic revelation today. Like, this canon is closed, buddy. There's no more scripture that's being added or created or whatever. Well, the Old Testament canon was closed after Malachi. There was no more prophetic revelation where a prophet came onto the scene, thus says the Lord, that kind of thing. That had ended with Malachi. And many of the Jewish rabbis in Jesus' day considered the Old Testament, as we would call it — they wouldn't have called it that, right? But as we call it, to have been to be closed. There's no more books we're adding to that. It's done. It's definitive. It's finished. So God was silent in the respect that there was no more prophetic revelation. But God wasn't silent. He still spoke through dreams and to people. And, you know, you still had folks who would say, man, the Lord just had this message for him. Like, you still had that kind of stuff. And we have that today, too. You just didn't have the scriptural revelation that took place. Now, Israel, in Malachi's day, it was kind of in, I don't want to call it shambles. They were rebuilding, but they were not in the best place. And to back up a little bit further, kind of what how we got there was you had the kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom of Judah. You know, when King Solomon dies, his son rejects the advice of the elders, and the 10 northern tribes of Israel revolt against Solomon's son, Rehoboam. And the two southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, remain loyal to him. And so what happens from that point forward, and Rehoboam was only the third king of Israel. So we're very early in their history. So what happens after that is there's a split. The 10 northern tribes of Israel, Samaria is the capital. It's a rough go. Guys like Ahab, Omri, those are the kings of Israel, kind of a wicked, evil type place. Judah is where David's line comes from and flows through. Their capital is Jerusalem, and they're the southern kingdom. Well, in 722 BC, the Assyrians come out from what is today northern Iraq, and they swallow up the Middle East. They destroy Israel. Hosea is the last king of Israel to take him off into exile. They took all the Jewish people out of Israel. I mean, very few folks were left. And what the Assyrians would do is they would bring other conquered peoples and place them in other lands they had conquered. They did not want you to have any kind of semblance of nationalism or patriotism. So if we take folks that we conquered in, what's today Turkey, and we put them in Israel, well, they're not going to feel affinity for the land and the surroundings, and they're less likely to rise up against us. That's kind of what they did. Those 10 tribes are often referred to as the 10 lost tribes, because from that point forward, you really had a hard time getting true Jewish, I don't want to say it for lack of a better term, I guess bloodline, right, on your flowing from that people group. There's a lot of intermingling with Gentiles and Jews from that part of Israel that took place. And really, for the Jews who are left in the land, they married again with, non-Jewish people, Gentile folks, right? And that's how you had the Samaritan race, which came about in northern Israel in Jesus' day. But the Jews in the south, in Judah, a different story. They continued to reign. 586 BC, the Babylonians come in, and for the third and final time, the first time they came was in 605 BC, then again in 597 BC. But in 586 BC, they come in for the third and final time. They destroy Jerusalem. The last king of Judah, Zedekiah, they gouge his eyes out. The last thing he sees, for his eyes are gouged out, are the deaths of his sons and the nobles. And Judah is taken off into exile in Babylon, and the poorest of the poor are left in Judah. But a different story here, because you didn't intermingle people groups. If you came from the tribes of Benjamin and Judah, you largely preserved your Jewish ethnicity, like full extent. So they're in exile in Babylon, which is today Iraq. Babylon was right outside of Baghdad. Around 70 years or so, give or take, the Jewish people begin to go back to Israel. So Persia becomes the big kingdom to control the Middle East. In fact, the Persian Empire swallows up the Middle East after Babylon, after Assyria, and they control it all the way up through to the time of the Romans even. And the Persians had this guy named King Cyrus, and Cyrus releases the Jews and other people who were conquered back to their homelands. Now, he doesn't do this out of an act of like goodwill. Hey guys, we're so sorry we conquered you and other folks conquered you. Can you go back home? That's not why he does that. He does it because the Persians had respect for civilizations they deemed, older than their own, particularly faiths and religious spiritual practices older than their own. The Jewish people certainly would have fallen under that category. And what they reasoned was, look, if we let them go back to their homelands, they'll pray to their gods. I mean, the Persians were polytheists, so they believed in many gods. They'll pray to their gods, and they'll sacrifice to their gods, and we will gain the favor of the deities of those peoples, and it will go well for us as an empire. That was the motivation for letting these people go back to their homelands. Now, does that mean God didn't keep his promise? No, of course not. God used Cyrus, he talks about this, that he'll use Cyrus as his tool, as his vessel, his conduit for accomplishing his purpose and releasing the people back into back to their homeland from captivity. That's precisely what God does. He works in and through the course of human events, something we call providence. Providence is God working through the course of human events to carry out his will. That's what he does there. So the Jews go back and they begin to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. And this is the time period of guys like Nehemiah and Ezra and Obadiah and Haggai and, yes, of course, Malachi as well. The Persians were doing well until a guy named Alexander the Great comes along. Alexander the Great and his Greek army, man, they just raced through the Middle East. They were the bane of the Persians' existence. And Alexander defeats the Persian Empire, most of it anyway. I did tell you they were around when the Romans came. They were. They kind of come back a little bit once Alexander falls apart. And the reason why Alexander's empire falls apart is because Alexander the Great violates the one rule that every emperor should never violate. You have one job. You want to be an emperor? You got one job. Have an heir. Okay? And Alexander did not have an heir. And so when he dies in what is today India, northern India, what happens is, his empire is broken apart, and his generals all take a piece of his empire, split up into different sections. Now, the two sections that I'm just going to talk about very briefly, because they concern Israel, are the Ptolemies, which would have been Egypt and parts of North Africa, and the Seleucids. The Seleucids would have had what is today Israel and Syria and Lebanon. That whole Mediterranean coastline, you know, parts of Jordan even, like that would have been where the Seleucids were at. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids went back and forth fighting for many years. Israel was kind of caught in the middle of all of their battles, by the way. And Israel changed hands many times during these skirmishes and these fights and battles. In 175 BC... there's a guy named Antiochus IV Epiphanes who becomes the ruler of the Seleucid Empire. Now, this is something that you need to keep in mind about the Seleucids. Up until Antiochus IV here, they had left the Jewish people alone for the most part. Hey, you have an old faith. You're an old people group. We're going to let you worship your God and do your thing and kind of leave you alone because we respect the antiquity of your culture and your faith. Antiochus IV really changes that. And he comes in and he adopts the name Epiphanes, which is Greek for God manifest. And that kind of gives you an idea of who this guy is. Antiochus saw himself as a living deity. And he causes all kinds of issues, not just for the Jewish people, but also for, you know, the Ptolemies in Egypt. And Rome at this point now is a growing force. And Rome is kind of watching what's happening in this part of the world because they're taking, you know, Carthage and Hannibal, like that whole all those wars, man, are starting to teeter out a little bit with Rome, and they're looking for some strategic places to attack Carthage, North Africa from, and so they have their eyes on the Middle East, and that actually leads to something Rome's going to do here in a little bit that I'll get to, but. Antiochus IV decides, you know, what he's going to do, he's going to sacrifice a pig on the altar in the temple. And he had such disdain for the Jewish people. He sacrifices a pig on the altar, does this multiple times, actually. He forces the high priests and other Jewish elites to actually eat pork under penalty of death. And so a massive revolt happens after all of this. Now, I'm being very broad. You can read more detail in other sources, but I'm just going to, for our time and our purpose, I'll be broad today. So, massive revolt happens. A guy named Jason was the high priest, and Antiochus deposed. He leads the revolt of the Jewish people against Antiochus Epiphanes. This happens in 167 BC, and the Maccabean revolt, the Maccabees, if you heard that term before, they are at war with the Greeks, with the Seleucids. In 152 BC, they're victorious. Now, you know, it's kind of like, all right, we caught the tiger by its tail. Well, what do we do? Okay, we won. By the way, this would have been the time of Hanukkah. Hanukkah and the story of Hanukkah and the temple and how there was enough oil in the lamps for one day, but it miraculously went 8 days. Jesus would have celebrated Hanukkah, by the way. that takes place during this time period as well. But the Maccabees are victorious in 152 BC, and they decide, you know what we're going to do is we're gonna fight it out again. There's a little bit of infighting about what kind of system is going to get set up, who's going to rule. In 140 BC, the victorious party comes to power, the Hasmoneans. They become the rulers of Israel. So 140 to 37 BC, you kind of have this period, a little over 100 years, and kind of have this period of self-rule among the Jewish people. Now, I say kind of because Rome was really interested in what was going on, and they kind of kept meddling a little bit in the affairs of Israel. In fact, in 63 BC, Julius Caesar heads over to Rome, or heads over to Israel with his Roman legions. Again, this has to do with a strategic position in the wars against Carthage. So Israel's just in a very strategic place, period, being the land bridge to Europe, Africa, and Asia, right? I mean, you kind of want to control, and you have ports on the Mediterranean, you kind of want to control that area. So Rome kind of meddled a lot, but for the most part, the Jewish people were under the self-rule. But that's going to change, though. In 76 BC, there's a civil war. Hasmonean civil war breaks out, and this opens the door for Rome to come in and provide stability. The Romans did not come into Israel as conquerors, and the people did not see the Romans as these terrible oppressors. They actually welcomed Rome almost as liberators when the Romans came in. And that sounds kind of odd, but if your country is being torn apart in civil war for decades, you kind of want it to stop, right? Like, is everybody who can do something, do it to let it stop? Well, the Romans came in and they put a stop to it. And they set up Judea as a client state. And they put a king on the throne there. And in 37 BC, the guy they put on the throne is not Jewish. This is on purpose. This is not by accident. They put a guy on the throne named Herod. And you know him as Herod the Great. Herod becomes the king in 37 BC. I said he's not Jewish. He's Idumean. If you look at your scriptures, Idumea sounds kind of like Edom. And that's because it's the same name. Okay. Edom was a people group nation to the southeast corner, if you want to call it that, where Israel's at, and they're the descendants of Esau. You go back to the story of Jacob and Esau. Jacob, who God changes the name to Israel, the Jewish people descend from him. Edom has the Edomites, and think of Edom as kind of like the Jewish cousins, right? Israel's cousins in a way, ethnically speaking, they are. And so the Hasmoneans had come in, and they had conquered Idumea during their self-rule period, and they had forced the Idumean people to convert to Judaism. So here's what Rome saw. Rome saw, okay, we can put a guy on the throne who's not Jewish, and that's going to clamp down any kind of Jewish pride, nationalism. We're gonna put that to an end by having a non-Jewish king on the throne. However, he's a Jew by faith, by religion. He's a convert. So he'll still keep the peace because he'll allow the practices and the worship and ritual and ceremony, which is really important in Jewish life. And he likes the Romans. He kind of cozies up to them. So they're like, you know, Herod be the perfect guy to put in this position. So Herod is given this role. He completes the temple, by the way, which had been, not destroyed completely, but it had been severely beaten and battered with all the different wars that have been happening. But Herod finishes it. So Herod's temple is what you see standing today. If you go to Israel, the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, right? That's part of Herod's temple that he built. Herod is the new king in 6 BC, which sounds familiar to some of you guys if you know your history. Jesus is born, we think, in either 4 or 6 BC, one of the two. But in 6 BC, Rome decides they're going to consolidate Judea, Idumea, and Samaria into the Roman state of Judea. They were three different states. Now they're going to be one big state called Judea, and Herod is going to be the guy who will have control over all of it as king. Again, You want to make sure that there is peace in the area. And Herod, they felt, was the guy who could do that. And, you know, he was a ruthless guy. I mean, Herod thought he killed his own family, own kids. I think he had his wife killed, if I believe correctly, as well, because he thought they were conspiring against him. So when the Magi come talking about Jesus and the Messiah and the King of the Jews, it perks Herod's ears up a little bit because, man, I don't want another King of the Jews. So what Herod does is he decides all children, well, not children, but boys, right? Boys ages 2 and under, which gives you a time period. The Magi, I know you want your nativity set to look nice, but the Magi weren't there. They stop at a house in Bethlehem. Scripture tells us Jesus, the word we see in the Greek for Jesus describes a toddler. So he would have been around that toddler age. That's also why Herod says, hey, boys 2 and under, we're going to take these guys out in Bethlehem. And he slaughters them. And it's just kind of this, you know, it's interesting dynamic, right? I mean, Jacob and Esau had a rivalry set up. Jacob stole the birthright, which belonged to Esau. And Esau hated Jacob for it. And he was going to kill Jacob the next time he saw him. So Jacob flees to his uncle Laban. And then Jacob comes back and Esau is like, hey, it's all good. I got a lot of stuff. I'm blessed. We're all right, man. We're cool. It's interesting to see it play out in a different way all these hundreds and hundreds of years later with Herod, a descendant of Esau, trying to stamp out a descendant of Jacob being Jesus, right? Because his belief is that his birthright is the throne of Israel. He won't let it go. Just a crazy, interesting thing to consider and think about, right? So Herod obviously doesn't succeed and he dies. And when he dies, there is instability. And if you're Rome, I know we think of the Romans as, well, they had this massive empire conquering like most of Europe and the British Isles and North Africa. And they, you know, we think these great warriors and, you know, maybe we think of them as oppressors. I don't know. But what Rome valued above all else was peace. I know it sounds crazy, but they had this actual policy, Pax Romana, the Roman peace. They valued peace above all else, peace and stability. And if you mess with that, they have a problem with it. And the Romans looked at what happened and they said, you know what? We have an issue here with Herod having passed away, and we do not like the results we're getting from his successors. And so what Rome did was they decided to split Judea into four sections. And so you had Perea, which is the East Bank today. If you look on a map, East Bank is Palestinian territory. This would have been where John the Baptist ministered. This is where he would have been, the wilderness out that way, the Jordan River, baptizing folks. Herod Antipas, he's the guy who kills John the Baptist, executes him. John the Baptist called out Herod for the adultery he was committing with his brother's wife. And then there's a whole scene where Herod Antipas's daughter comes in and dances and asks for John's head in a silver platter, and he has to do it, and it's just this terrible story, right? But that's Perea. Then you have Galilee. Galilee is northern Israel. This is where the Dead Sea is at. Jesus is there. We'll talk more about Galilee in a little bit, but this would have been an interesting section of the country. A lot of Greeks are in Galilee, and the Jewish folks who lived in Galilee were far less religious and zealous as the ones who lived elsewhere. You had the Tetrarch of Philip, which had been northwest Galilee, all right, kind of towards the coast. And then you had Samaria and Judea. Now, Samaria and Judea had so much conflict. You could, no matter who was put over control of this section, the successors were just run out of town. They were failing left and right to keep peace and tranquility and everything else. So Rome said, all right, we're done with this. We're going to put our own man over this section that is a hotbed. And they put a procurator, a Roman governor, and they put a guy named Pontius Pilate to rule this large section which included Jerusalem, with an iron fist. Now, we think of Pilate as some kind of pushover, mistakenly so, from our Easter stories, because he gave in to the crowd who wanted Christ to be killed. But listen to me, and listen to me carefully. Pilate was ruthless. He was not a pushover. He was a dangerous person. He was a hard, iron-fisted ruler. He didn't put up with any nonsense. If you read what little we have about Pilate from other sources, this guy is not someone you cross. He ruled with an iron fist. And sometimes, you know, you need strong men. I know this sounds very, it sounds very opposite of, you know, being American. Well, democracy and republic and you vote or whatever. Listen, there are parts of the world you can't do that with. There are sections of the world where there is so much violence and conflict, and the people are so at each other's throats. You can't vote. You got to have an iron-fisted guy rule to keep the peace. Well, that's Pilate for this part of Judea, and that's what he did. So you also had what's called the Sanhedrin set up. The Sanhedrin was the local Jewish governing body. Rome doesn't want to interfere in the affairs of the Jewish people. In fact, the Jewish people were given a lot of autonomy. Rome didn't offer that to the Gauls, okay? They didn't offer that to the Britons. But they offer it to the British, or the British, see what I did there? They offer it to the Jewish people in Israel because, again, there's this great respect for people groups and faiths that are older than their own. You kind of see a pattern here. The Persians had that. The Romans have that. The Greeks have that. So they give a lot of autonomy to Israel. In fact, the Sanhedrin can do whatever they want to do except execute people. Only Rome can do that. And they govern the local affairs of all the Jewish folks. Now, who makes up the Sanhedrin? Well, it's a 17-member governing body. And the high priest chairs the Sanhedrin. Now, the high priest at this point was no longer a descendant of Aaron. That line was done and gone away, and it had become super political. It's not anything like what you're used to in the Old Testament. So you need to understand the high priest is not the same kind of high priest as you learned about in the Old Testament era. But the high priest chairs it, and there were three main parties, and I'll talk about two in detail. The one party I won't talk much about today is the Essenes. The Essenes were, I don't think they even had a seat on the Sanhedrin, to be honest with you. They may have had one, but I don't think they had very many, if that. But the Essenes were kind of to themselves. These guys were the Amish, if you want to think of it like a good parallel term. You know how the Amish live to themselves and they do their own thing and kind of isolated from society? That would have been the Essenes. But we're glad we have the Essenes. You know why? Because when the Romans come in and destroy Jerusalem in AD 70, and they finally destroy Masada, it's the Essenes who preserve what we know today as the Dead Sea Scrolls. If we don't have the Essenes, we don't have the Dead Sea Scrolls. They preserved all kinds of ancient manuscripts and clay pots, hid them from the Romans, and for thousands of years they survived, right? Until they were discovered in the 19th century. So thanks to the Essenes, man, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls and other manuscripts that we thought were just, you know, were works of fiction maybe, or just lost to time, but we actually have them today. But the two parties that made up the Sanhedrin for the most part, you have the Pharisees, working class guys, blue collar dudes. They're not great theologians, by the way. They're very pious. They're intelligent. They're not dummies. But they're just not the kind of guy that you would expect to, give you this wonderful sermon with in-depth theological instruction and application. That you're barking up the wrong tree here with these guys. They were very active in their synagogues. They were very active in the day-to-day lives of their people. Think of the Pharisees as kind of like, you know, the staff pastors of, you know, I've been on staff at multiple sized churches. The staff pastors at larger churches do a lot of pastoral care work, right? They're the guys who are involved in funerals and weddings and hospital visits and all. These guys are among the people, okay? And they had an oral tradition that they held to the Mosaic law. Now, The Mosaic Law was not something they took literally. It was interpreted orally. Now, before you raise an objection to that, I want you to understand this time period. A lot of people couldn't read or write. So what you have is you have things passed down by oral tradition. So the Pharisees would recite and memorize entire books of the Bible. Like, these guys know the Old Testament inside and out. They've memorized it. And they pass it on. And because it was such an oral culture, everyone could remember things, and they trained themselves to remember stories and great works of art and theology, whatever else. And so you would correct somebody if they were telling the story wrong. How do we know this? Because we have Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, which were written down several hundred years later from when he actually told the stories. And we don't look at the Iliad and Odyssey as if they're anything different from what Homer said. No, we believe they're the exact words that Homer used, because we have faith in the oral tradition of ancient peoples, right? So you would have done things orally, and it would have been caught. Mistakes would have been caught. So I'm very confident mistakes, a lot of scholars are too, there were not mistakes made in the oral tradition of the Pharisees. Now, here's the problem with this, though. Because things were oral and there was so much tradition involved, tradition and custom, and the law was not literal for a lot of these guys because of that, it allowed the Pharisees to interpret what they thought the intent of the law was. There were 6,000 additional laws added from what Moses was originally handed by God on Sinai in the New Testament era. That's a lot, right? That's an awful lot of stuff. And that's why the Pharisees feel threatened by Jesus, because Jesus comes along and he's like, dude, I am the law of Moses, which is enough to shake people in their boots. And he's interpreting the law as God gave it to Moses and intended it to be in the Old Testament era. And the Pharisees don't have an interpretation which matches that, and it bothers them and it angers them that Jesus could possibly, this guy who didn't go to rabbinical school and wasn't trained to be a rabbi, that, and he's coming out here and he's telling us with our education, our background, he's telling us what these laws should be. Now, not all the Pharisees were bad guys. I mean, like Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, they became followers of Christ. They were Pharisees. Nicodemus, by the way, was a very well-respected Pharisee in his time. And Joseph of Arimathea was a very wealthy guy, a very wealthy individual. So not all of them were opponents of Christ, but a lot of them had issues with Jesus because of his interpretation not aligning with their own, okay? Now, you had another group called the Sadducees, and these guys were the elite of Judea. They controlled the priesthood. Caiaphas was the high priest in Jesus' day. He's a Sadducee. Annas, his father-in-law, who was the high priest before, he was a Pharisee, a Sadducee as well. These guys mostly centered their control in Jerusalem, where they had the majority of the Sanhedrin seats as well. And they're an interesting bunch. The Sadducees believed that only the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, was authoritative. So the prophets and the writings and the Psalms and, you know, all that was no bueno, right? No good. It's great for custom. It's great for tradition. It's great for national pride and Jewish pride. But, you know, those are not divine books. In fact, divine would not probably be in the Sadducees' vocabulary, because these guys rejected the supernatural. I call them closet atheists, because that's kind of what they were, right? I mean, like, they didn't believe in angels or demons or heaven or hell or eternity. They didn't believe anything supernatural. For them, everything was about ritual, tradition, and ceremony. And Moses and the story of the Exodus didn't happen the way that it's told. It's not some supernatural parting of the sea. It's just our story of the Jewish people and the narrative we put out there of how we came into being and our laws for governing and whatever. Because again, if you're a Sadducee, you don't believe in anything divine. You don't believe in this kind of stuff. And they don't have a problem with Jesus. I mean, Jesus ministers for 3 years, 3.5 years. They don't have a problem for most of his time. Where they kind of perk up is when Lazarus comes back to life, because dead people are supposed to stay dead, right? And so Lazarus comes back to life, and they have an issue with that. Like, wait a minute, that's not supposed to happen. Who is this guy? Now, you and I would like to think that if we were Sadducees and we heard about Lazarus coming back to life, and we have verified reports from eyewitnesses who saw him dead and now he's alive, that we'd say, holy cow, we are wrong. And we are wrong by a mile about this stuff. That's not what these guys do. They dig their heels. In fact, they actually seek to kill Lazarus too. They want to kill Lazarus and Jesus as a result of that. From that point forward, they got an issue with Jesus. And what the Sadducees do is they approach Judas. It's not the Pharisees who actually orchestrate this kind of stuff. It's the Sadducees. These guys form the Jewish leadership that approaches Judas. And they orchestrate the betrayal. And they do the trials in the middle of the night, which are not legal by Jewish law at that time. But they had the trials for Christ. They bring him to Pilate. We got to kill him. Pilate says, no, we're not going to do that. And this kind of whole tussle back and forth kind of goes between the Sadducees and Pilate. And it's really their show. The Pharisees are the main opposition for most of the ministry. And then at the end, and it's the Passion Week, it's the Sadducees. All because of what? Because Lazarus came back to life, and that ain't supposed to happen. That was the big trigger for these guys to really oppose Jesus, okay? Now, it wasn't just the Sanhedrin who you got to think about being in control of things in that time period. Yes, they were the local governing body for Jewish people in the way of life, but there were also political factions as well. And there were two main political factions that we got to talk about, because one of them actually impacts Jesus directly. So you have what's called the Zealots. These guys were strong conservatives. Strong conservatives. They violently opposed Roman rule. They were all about setting up a Davidic kingdom again, and the throne of David, and Jewish nationalism, and Jewish pride, and a Jewish kingdom. They wanted all that restoration back to the glory days of Israel. Okay. Simon, one of Christ's followers, was a zealot. He was part of this group. And they had led a lot of failed rebellions against Rome, by the way. Zealots were terrorists as far as Rome was concerned. And Simon was a part of that group. There were fewer in number in Galilee, where Jesus was at. But they were largely based throughout the rest of Judea. In AD 66, that's about 35, 36 years after Christ is crucified and risen again, there's a court case that goes against the Jewish people, goes the way of the Gentiles. What do the Gentiles do? Well, they celebrate by going into some Jewish neighborhoods and just slaughter people left and right. Think about October 7th. From last year in Israel, and what happened in 2023, what happened with in Israel, and how many Jews were killed when Hamas went in and just slaughtered people all over the place. That's what these guys did. The exact same thing. And the Zealots hear about it, and what do? They lead a revolt against Rome. They actually destroy and massacre Roman soldiers and garrisons all across the countryside, and that causes the final Roman-Jewish war to take place. And in AD 70, Rome comes in, destroys Jerusalem, destroys the temple, and the Jewish people are scattered throughout the known world from that point forward, until 1948 when Israel's created again, and there becomes another mass exodus of Jews back to the nation of Israel. But the Zealots were the guys who were behind that last and final revolt against Rome. The Herodians were the other group. Herodians are the other political faction. They cooperated with Rome and Herod. They were mostly centered in Jerusalem, Judea. They were conformists. They were elitists. These guys, from a religious standpoint, they would have been tied to the Sadducees. By the way, the Zealots, from a religious point of view, would have been more pharisaical, have been tied to the Pharisees. And they had all the seats of power, the Herodians did, for the most part. They really controlled a lot of things. They were cozy with Rome. And they had an issue with Jesus, too, because they felt their power was threatened by his growing popularity. Jesus was definitely a populist, and he had the hearts of the people, and that scared the junk out of these guys. They did not like that. And so they were all in favor of his execution as well by crucifixion. From a cultural point of view, Israel is kind of split up in a couple of different ways. One, and you have a large contingent of what we call Hellenistic Jews in northern Israel. This is where Jesus would have been grown up in, and in Galilee and Capernaum and the Dead Sea area, the Decapolis, which are the 10 cities, that whole area up there. Hellenistic Jews, who are these guys? Well, Hellenistic is from Hellenism, which is Greek, okay? And it meant that these were Jews who maybe they had a Greek father or mother and a Jewish father or mother. Maybe they were Jews who had Jewish, both parents were Jewish, but they grew up in this kind of region where they were the minority. And so they understood how to read Greek and speak Greek. And they understood Greek customs and spiritual practices and different cultural structures and that they had in place. They could relate to these guys very easily. Paul was a Hellenistic Jew. It's what made Paul so successful as he traveled the Roman Empire, planting churches, raising up leaders, okay? Jesus would have been born. He would have grown up in this area in Galilee, and a lot of his followers were from here too, and they had an easier time relating to Greeks, to Gentiles, to Jews who were a little bit more lax, we'll say, not quite as devoted to Judaism as their Hebrew counterparts. Then you have the Hebraic Jews. The Hebraic Jews are the guys who were in Jerusalem and the heart of Israel itself, a lot of Judea, that whole area down there. They didn't speak Greek, if at all. They didn't understand it very well. They had a strong disdain for Greek culture and custom and different practices. And they were very strong in their Hebrew roots and their own spiritual disciplines and in their ethnicity. Guys like Peter would have been a Hebraic Jew for sure. They would have been staunchly opposed to a lot of the things that Rome was doing. And to what their leadership, because the Jewish leadership is not, even though Jewish leadership resides in Jerusalem, by and large, they're not identifying with Hebraic Jews. They're more Hellenistic, okay? They're aligning with these guys over here, the Hellenistic Jews. And that's kind of what they would have, Hebraic Jews and Hellenists, that's kind of the cultural divide you would have had between Jewish people. I mean, think about our world today. We have Democrats and Republicans. I don't want to get all political, but if you just think about it, if you're a Democrat or if you're a Republican, right, there's some pretty significant nowadays differences culturally, politically. Same thing in that era. Hellenistic Jews, Hebraic Jews, they were similar, but there were some really big differences. And Jesus has varying degrees of success and opposition in different parts of Israel based on who makes up the majority of his audience. A lot of his miracles are done where? Northern Israel, Galilee, Capernaum, a Hellenistic Greek presence. These guys are more open to this kind of stuff because they're not staunch Jewish, not Judaizers, but, you know, staunchly zealous and pious in their faith and in their practice. He has a harder time in the southern parts of Israel, where there's a much stronger hold of Hebraic Jews, okay? That's just a tougher place for him to minister to for obvious reasons. So that's kind of the culture. That's the language. That's the political factions. That's how the people are governed. You kind of got an idea of the world that he's walking into. He's walking into a world that is controlled by Rome. Rome has the government structure set up. Rome has citizenship systems in place, which gives you special privileges if you're a citizen. And they're the big dogs on the block. The world is culturally influenced by Alexander the Great and the Greeks. Yeah, there's peace and stability that Rome created, But the Greek language and culture and the customs and practices, man, it's all over the place, particularly in northern Israel, where Christ would have ministered and spent a lot of his time at. A lot of people would have known about the Messiah coming. They have been looking for a Messiah. This is a time period where the Jewish people, whether you were Hellenistic or Hebraic, it didn't matter. You were looking for the Messiah. A lot of folks were ready for this. And there were people who popped up here and there saying, hey, I'm the guy, I'm the one, only to find out they weren't. So it wasn't shocking to hear Jesus claim, you know, indirectly he was the Messiah. I think a lot of people, when they first heard those reports, were kind of like, okay, you know, another guy, another day, whatever. It wasn't until you started hearing about the miracles, you know, feeding of the 5,000, which is really probably more like 10 or 12,000 or more, dead people coming back to life, Lazarus, the sick, you know, little Jairus' sick girl, you know, who had passed away, and Jesus is not, she's only sleeping, and everyone kind of laughed at him, and she was, right? Lepers being healed, the blind seeing. See, all these reports begin to surface, and all the guys who came before claiming to be the Messiah, they didn't do those things. And that's what piqued the people's interest. And it began to swell. His followers began to swell. He had all kinds of followers. We think of Jesus having his 12 followers. No, he had many, many, many followers. He had 12 apostles, 12 students he personally taught directly. And of those 12, there were three: Peter, James, and John, who went everywhere with Jesus. And that's what makes John such a great book to read, because John had the eyewitness accounts that the other disciples were not privy to see. And he had some connections. John, the reason we know about Peter in the courtyard of the priests is because of John. A lot of scholars believe John had connections to the high priest's home and were able to see some things that other guys just weren't able to see. If you read Mark's gospel, when Mark has Peter denying Jesus as well, but he only has part of the story. Why? Because Peter was telling Mark his account, and Peter was not able to go in to the priest's residence like John was and see things firsthand the way John was able to see. That's why John's account has more detail and is fuller about, you know, than Peter or Mark's. So, you know, John just went all over the place. And this is going to be a great, great teaching series that we walk through. And I really believe that you're going to learn a lot. Whether you're someone who's got questions about your faith and God and that kind of thing, or you're somebody who's been a believer for a long time, you're going to get challenged. You're going to grow. And I believe that spiritually speaking, you're going to have a closeness with the Lord, man, with Jesus, that maybe you haven't had before. When it's all said and done. So I'll pop on every so often, do some of these kind of episodes to fill the gaps in here and there when I get a chance to do that. But now you know the world that Jesus was entering into, and I hope that helps you as we read through John's gospel together and we journey through this life of Jesus as told by the self-described apostle whom Jesus loved, right? All right, well, thanks for tuning in, man. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we'll see you guys later. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or would like to reach out to us, you can do so by emailing us at media@gradientchurchsc.com or visit one of our social accounts on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. If you like what you heard today, subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes, and give us a 5-star rating on the podcast platform that you listen to. We hope you have an amazing rest of your day.